So this week, we're starting with this new chapter, chapter 8. We've been working our way through chapter 7. And at the very beginning of chapter 8, as I think I wrote in the guidance, what it basically says is that in chapter 7, we were laying out the theory, and now in chapter 8, we want to actually have an experience of second level time. So the previous chapter was to orient us. Now we didn't use it exactly that way. We're not being obedient students of the book. And I mentioned that in the guidance that you know the book says, well, you know, it's very, very important. You have to be able, you have to have had some experience of great space, and you should go back and read the great space sections. And I kind of apologize for the fact that we haven't done that. But we are doing what Rinpoche suggests as a second approach toward developing a second level experience of time, and that is to question the central role of the self. And that really is the position. I see Arthur is doing something. Okay.
Yeah, I'm wondering if there's a huge delay.
A huge delay, that's possible.
That would be pretty significant. But anyway, sorry to interrupt.
It was my interruption, I'm sorry. Okay, we are following basically the suggestion, the guidance that's given here in this chapter about how to move toward a second level appreciation of time, which is to look at the self and question our usual way of understanding, which puts the self at the center. Now there is a broader way of thinking about how to experience time differently, or what it's like to experience time differently, and that is the focus on openness. You know, in the first paragraph here, it says they require. Okay, we're talking about different experiences of time. And he says, we have to have more openness in viewing our realm. And that's kind of the guiding principle. And of course, you can see why the focus then is naturally on space, because openness and space pretty much go together. But it's also true that throughout this chapter, Rinpoche keeps coming back to this theme of openness. And actually, one place to look at that, we'll get into it a little more later, but when Rinpoche introduces the object in its glow exercise, which was right at the end of our reading, he talks about it again in terms of openness. And he says, a more broadly based knowing. That's, you know, that's how he describes this possibility of seeing yourself as being the glow, or seeing the self as being the glow of the object. And he says this initially, at least, may simply mean being more open-minded. And in the commentary, he talks about seeing a new way that situations are open. So I don't want to pound that point into the ground, but I do think it's really important to understand that in order to experience time differently, we need to be more open-minded, more open to different ways of experiencing, in kind of a literal sense. So that's really what we want to allow for. Now, it's very easy to say we need to be more open to our experience, we need to be ready to entertain possibilities, but of course it's our natural inclination to not to be closed. That's not really the point. I mean, it's not like we set out to be closed, but we are committed to a certain way of being, committed to a certain way of understanding time. And it's that commitment that we have to loosen up or dissolve or open. And that is really you could say what we're working for in this whole unit, this whole session we're having on time through these 9 weeks. Now, we've been doing exercise 16, or rather, 16, space-time knowledge on the ordinary level, for these many weeks. And then this last week I asked you to do object and its glow as well. But I'd like to speak directly to exercise 16, because in exercise 16 we're asked very specifically to do exactly what Rinpoche says at the beginning of this chapter. We're asked to take a more open view with respect to the position of the self, and to think about or look at the possibility that instead of putting the self at the center of experience, we could put time or space or knowledge at the center of experience. So I'd like to ask you to talk about that, and Sudaba, I don't want to put you on the spot, but you said something very interesting. Sudaba is in another class that I teach, and she brought up an experience she had sometime in the last week or so, that directly related in her mind to exercise 16. So I wonder if you'd be willing to describe that for the group here.
Can you hear me?
Yes?
Yes.
This was, I have been practicing it since, I think the second week, and that has been my main practice after Kune in the morning I do. So it's been a while for me to do that and not do other things. And I was about 10 days ago in Costco, and something very unusual for me, it happened when I reflected back on it as soon as I got in the car. I was picking up a grocery, and one of them was a big packet of, I don't know, 18 eggs. And it was in one of these flimsy see-through plastics that he wasn't holding it, but I did it with one hand. So the whole thing just collapsed and fell, and it was a big mess. And then the people in the line were just yelling because there was a long, long thing. Oh, scrambled eggs! And so, but what was so amazing was I could tune into the other two who were assisting the cashier and her assistant, and it dawned on me that, you know, just like this morning, time presents. That was the exercise. Because time is presenting. This. It's meant to happen, and there isn't knowing, you know, that was exactly in my mind, and I did not budge. It was so unusual for me to, I mean, I went through the motion. When I heard scrambled eggs yelling, for a second, a fraction of a second, the thought came, that, gosh, do you have to shut up? Do you have to say that? And then another second was, yeah, they're in line. It's going to take them longer. So you understand, like I could be in everyone's position. But because it was so shocking, the experience, that I did not feel my anxiety. I felt I was so calm. I could see all the perspectives from the people who were yelling in the line. And then this was amazing. I could think. I was so as if functional. Usually in this moment, I am so just frozen and going through anxiety inside of me that I can't think. But I was shocked. I suggested to the two assistants, get one of these boxes that is laying around and put it underneath so it won't drip because they were going to move it to another location, another guy was going to clean it. So at least it won't make a mess. I couldn't believe how I was thinking, and I wasn't nervous. Anyhow, make the story short, a few minutes later, within 5 minutes, they took care of me, they gave me a new egg, and they were very pleasant, and I was in my car. But I was thinking, reflecting, that this was not a small thing that just happened. I have never been like this. So I knew it in my heart that this practice was doing something, that something else is in control, and then I could relax and tune in to, as if in one level it was my ordinary way of thinking, but in another way, what that was not me. I'm normally so nervous in this situation. So I attributed it was the practice was working for me. So I'm doing it, that I'm not in the center. Something else is the knowing of this space and the time. The time is presenting, and I'm just one of these many, many people in this bouquet. So that was, in short, my experience.
Okay. Good. Well, thank you. I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but I thought it was a great example of what's involved in taking a more open view, and it does seem to me to be related to to exercise 16 and to what's being talked about here. I think one of the characteristics when people start to do practice, well, I'll just tell you a very quick story that was not a TSK story, but many years ago when I was starting to take classes at the Institute, I also took a beginning yoga class, the only yoga class I've ever taken. And I remember the instructor, somebody asked her about the benefits of yoga, and she said, well, one thing I've noticed is that when I'm in traffic and I'm stopped at a traffic light or someone's coming in the opposite direction at a stop sign, I don't feel so impatient anymore. I feel very willing to let the situation unfold. And at the time, I remember thinking, well, that's nothing. You know, we're talking about enlightenment. I mean, we're interested in serious stuff, not about being more patient at traffic lights. But after a few more years of practice, I realized that that's a very false dichotomy, and that the way that you really understand what a practice means is to see how it affects you in your daily life. So I think Sudaba's example is a good one. So I want to ask if anybody else has any anything they'd like to share about how the practice has been going, or anything they've noticed either in the practice or through doing the practice. And by the practice, I mean really exercise 16, but also everything that we've been doing. Anybody want to say anything about that? Nope. Okay. Well, maybe as you look ahead in the next week, maybe in, you know, the exercise 16 and exercise 17, which is the object and its glow, both have as their aim this idea of, you know, literally you could say, decentering the self.
Jack?
Yes.
Excuse me. Pat doesn't have the ability to speak, and she did send a chat message.
Okay, I actually don't see it here. Maybe she just
just
to you.
Yeah, she sent it privately.
Okay.
It was just walking in a botanical park, a beautiful botanical park last week.
Mm-hmm.
So that was her experience.
Okay, so there was an experience of time or timing or the self not being at the center. Yeah, I'm not, it's not like I'm telling you you've got to have some kind of extra special experience, but it is helpful to look within your experience for moments that feel more open or in some way, yeah, more appreciative of the flow of time and your presence, your engagement with what's going on in the world. I don't want to say around you, because that would put the self at the center. Simply your experience, and your experience is a part of what's going on in the world. Okay.
She also wrote, I'm sorry, light wind blowing leaves and little pieces of blossoms raining down, sun shimmering on leaves, seemed like everything was vibrating and shimmering,
Okay.
vibrating and alive.
Okay, good. Thank you, Pat. And again, it's not like, you have to have a particular experience or any experience at all, but the sense of timing, kind of questioning that, opening it up, being ready for other possibilities, that's where we're looking. And even a little bit, as Rinpoche says, let's see, I think it's in the second paragraph of this chapter, he says, he says, even a slight increase in the understanding of space will allow more insight into time. And although he puts that in terms of space, I think that the real point here is that if we are more open to the possibilities that time presents, that's when we begin to appreciate what Rinpoche is talking about here, a second level, second stage experience of time. So the question is, why can't we do that usually? And one answer, which we've talked about, is that is the self and our commitment to the self. The broader answer would be that we're committed to a particular structure order that has been timed out. There's a fundamental point, and I don't think Rinpoche says it exactly this way in this chapter, but he kind of does. It's that those diagrams that he does on page let's find it here. Pages 168 and 9, those little line drawings where we start off with a kind of unified, undivided, rich medium, that's time, that's the vertical line. And then from that, you get this kind of separating out until you end up with a horizontal line, which is, as he describes it, a facing off between two isolates in a finite slice of ordinary time. In other words, the subject and the object. Well, that facing off, what that means is that something has been set up, right? And what that means is that another way of saying that is something has been timed out, and it's done. We find ourselves in a situation, and again, I think it's really good to be sensitive to the kind of temporal dimension to the way we describe things. When we find ourselves in a situation, it's because we've been situated in that situation. Something has already happened. It's over and done. It's been timed out. And as a result of that, we find ourselves in this horizontal dimension. And I think once you think of that horizontal dimension, and Rinpoche just shows it as subject and object in a line, but it really is our whole world. We find ourselves in a world that has been timed out in advance. And when I was thinking about that these last few days, I started thinking about the word time out. So I want to just kind of play with that for a moment. So in English, the word time out as a noun usually means in a game when you ask for the clock to be stopped, right? And that's a time out. Time stops running. Usually, in a game, I'm thinking of football or basketball, something like that. Usually, the most common reason you might do that is because there's only a certain amount of time in the game, and you don't have much time left. So you need to do something. You need to stop the clock from running so that the game doesn't end. That's not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in a particular kind of time out that's teams will sometimes take, what happens is in a game, the momentum begins to shift, and one team is in control of the game, and the other team, let me just set one possible example. Your team, let's say, is becoming disorganized, and it's becoming, worried that it can't do what it's supposed to do, and it can't run the plays that it wants to run, and it's kind of losing confidence. So the coach in a situation like that might call a timeout. So what does that mean? Well, it seems to me that actually, if you think about a game, there's three different levels. One level is if you're really involved in the game and in the flow of the movement, the ball is being passed back and forth and so on, that actually is going in the direction of, and I think sometimes reaches, the level of a second level experience of time. And I don't know if you've ever read descriptions by athletes of entering into a kind of a different way of being in time, where everything seems to be moving very slowly, or even to be still, in the middle of a game. It seems as though they have all the time in the world to do what they want to do. It's that kind of thing. So that could be a second level flow, and I think that the experience of playing in a game can give you something like that. So that's a way of timing, and is dynamic and alive. It's a little like the description that Pat gave or that Sudaba gave. Okay, but the description that I was trying to point towards is where time takes on a certain structure, where things have been timed out, and you find yourself as the team trapped in a particular way of understanding what's happening. And what's happening is that the other team is in control. And at that time, a coach will sometimes take a time out. And I think what they're doing is saying, well, we have to stop this particular way in which things have been set up, this way in which things have been timed out. We are getting trapped in a structure, a temporal structure, and it's going in a direction we don't want. We have to step outside that and recreate it. So that's the reason I bring that example up. And I'm talking about it just in thinking of the term time out. Usually when we talk about something being timed out, we mean it has been set up. And here I'm saying a timeout in a sports event is the kind that I'm talking about, is a different timeout where you step out of that structure. You step out of the timed out structure. And in a sense, the exercises that we're doing are like that. Did someone want to say something? Did I hear someone? No? Okay. So when things get timed out in our ordinary understanding, they get timed out in terms of a self, right? And Rinpoche, throughout this chapter, talks about taking a wider perspective on the self, and exercise 17, the object and its glow, is about that. We would like to find ways to de-emphasize the self. Because as he says on page 166, he says the self is an embodiment of a lapse in understanding. That is, we understand time in a limited way. We understand it as giving us this past, present, future structure, this subject-object structure. And to understand things that way is to be a self, or to insist on the identity of a self over time is to fall victim to that limited form of understanding. And the difficulty the difficulty with that is that, the reason that happens is because we accept a certain structure, a certain account that's been given. You know, it's if you think of the word counting, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but if you think of the word counting, it's like something has been set up and you just count things to figure out what's been set up. And that's like giving an account of what's been set up. So the account that we give is that the self is at the center, and that means that it's a limited account. There's a lapse of understanding, as Rinpoche says. Rinpoche also says, though, that all of that is something that's given by time. And really, I think the main point in the reading today, you know, Rinpoche develops this notion of a story that's been told by time. And he talks about time, you know, and the stagehand and all these different descriptions. But the basic idea there is that whatever the story is, whatever the account is, and our particular account is that the self is at the center, and as a result, time has this past, present, future structure. So that story is in effect, but time is the one that's presenting the story. Right? The story is an embodiment of the dynamic of time. And the lapse in understanding is that we don't see that. But the possibility is always there that we could see it. And I think that's really what happens in the kinds of descriptions that we've been giving, or the kinds of descriptions that Sudaba gave and Pat gave. I mean, you know, doesn't have to be a big deal, but there are times when we do not feel as committed to the story that we're the one at the center. So in Sudaba's case, you know, if she's the one at the center, then everybody else is angry with her or making jokes at her expense or, you know, all of that, because the self is busy protecting its position and worried about its status and all of those things. But if it's just something that is a part of the dynamic of time, you say, well, time is, you know, the story has shifted in an interesting way, and now you're participating in it differently, and you're able to appreciate, as Sudaba was, for instance, able to appreciate the cooperation of the other people in the store, the employees in the store who helped her to clean things up, because she wasn't completely focused on her own situation and her own position in time. Right? And so one way to look at that is to look at the story of the self in a different light, and that's what the object in its glow, that's what that exercise is about. Now, I asked before about experiences with exercise 16. I'm going to ask again, although I'm not exact. Well, let me just ask. If anybody has been, has found anything in doing this exercise, the object in its glow, during the past week, because we're going to continue with it next week as well.
I had an experience where I considered, I figured if I was the glow, what was the object? So I thought about and considered time as the object. And then I had the experience of myself as the glow of time.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I think it's true that if you know, what goes with the self is a particular version of an object, and ordinarily it's an object that we happen to look at, or maybe an object that we're using, an object that somehow is meaningful to us. And the exercise really kind of, I think, starts from the idea that we work with an object like that. But the next step beyond that is to look at the whole objective situation and not separate out the self. And then, you know, a step beyond that might be to do what you were experimenting with, which is time as an object. Although I don't know exactly what that would mean, to take time as an object, but if it's meaningful for you, then that's fine. You know, whatever, especially at this level, you know, whatever new story, new version, new position, new possibility we can explore, whatever we can do to kind of shake up our ordinary experience is a good thing. And it doesn't depend on following along particularly with this or that understanding or this or that description by Rinpoche, or even necessarily with the exact language of the, you know, the exact description of the exercise. It's whatever it is that shakes up, that opens up our experience. and it goes in the direction, as Rinpoche says when he describes object in its glow, it goes in the direction of a kind of a unity. He talks about the appearance of separateness, and he says, and this goes right back to the idea that time is always active, whatever our appreciation, whatever our situation is. He says, the appearance of separateness bears the evidence for the no separation we seek. Now, when he says the no separation we seek, I think there's a little danger there of saying, oh, we're looking for something special. But if you read it in context, I think Rinpoche is not saying that. He's saying we want to put into play a different way of understanding. We want to do that because we want to open and challenge and question our usual understanding. So the way to do that is looking for a kind of a no separation experience, which is like the object in its glow. It's not so much that that's the goal, but we're looking for ways to challenge this timed out story in which we're so committed to the content of the story that we can't be aware of the dynamic of time itself. That's the fundamental distinction. Anybody else want to say anything about the object in its glow, about that exercise?
I just want to see if Arthur can say something. Arthur?
Yeah, hello?
Oh, can there you hear are. Me? Yes.
Yes? Great.
Okay, so yes. If you've spent 30 minutes wishing you could be saying something, here's your chance. Is that, do you want to say something?
I have very few understanding with this term of glow.
Mm-hmm.
When I work with this exercise, I have no idea with this glow.
Mm-hmm.
Object and something else, not mm-hmm. so problem, but glow, I'm totally in a fog.
Well,
yes.
So two things about that. One is our webmaster, Kyle Kossop, has been working for a while on an animation of the object and its glow. Maybe this would be a good time to put it up. So let's talk with Kyle about this, to put it on the website. So look for that. We'll see if that's helpful. The other thing I would say is that I've always found it actually easier to think in terms of a candle and its glow. Partly because I'm not sure I've ever seen a phosphorescent blossom. So with a candle in its glow, it seems to me at least the image is very clear. There's the kind of shape of the candle, and then without its becoming anything different, there's the halo of light around the candle. I don't know if it helps to put my hands in there. No, it doesn't. Okay, there's the halo of light around the candle. And I think in the case of a candle, it's really, really clear that the halo of light is just kind of, what can we say? You know, the fading out of the more intense light in the middle. And that suggests a kind of a oneness, and I think that that's where the exercise is going. But of course, the hard part is saying, "Well, but I'm the self." Okay, go ahead.
phosphorescent blooms in the desert.
Right. That's where that comes from. Right.
And the glow is actually within the boundaries of the shape of the flower. It goes a little beyond, but it's actually a form of this glow. It's actually inherent right in the color and in the shape of the flower itself.
Okay.
I'll see if I can get some pictures of it. It might be hard to capture, but it's more inherent in the shape than a candle in its glow.
Okay.
It's more, yeah.
Well, I understand. Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, if we had a picture, maybe that would help. And I'm, you know, Rinpoche specifically is talking about the kind of flower blossom that you're describing, a desert blossom. So that would be the place to look. The point, though, in a way, is this: that you know, we're decentering the self. And one thing that might be worth looking at there, and then we should really stop, is this interesting discussion that Rinpoche has right at the bottom, I think it is, of 169, the part that he has in italics, where he says, the power of time fragments, becoming the volition of the self on the one hand, set in contrast to the energy of nature and physical processes on the other. So the volition of the self is a manifestation of the energy of time. And you know, some of you may remember from last year or from your reading that in Love of Knowledge, Rinpoche turns that around and he says, the momentum of the self's desire, it's the same thing as the volition here, unfolds as the dynamic of linear time. He's saying the same thing, but he's coming at it from the other side. But it's very interesting to think about the volition of the self as being, you know, that's basically the subjective side of time. And so, you know, is that the glow of the flower or of the candle? Or is it something else? I think it's something to look at. We're out of time, so we won't look at it. I won't try to look at it right now, but maybe in the course of the next week we can look at it. And next week we skip a few pages because we're not going to work with those exercises, exercises 18 and the ones that follow. But you're welcome, of course, to try those on your own. I think that'd be great. You know, it's always helpful to do the experiential part of this. But we'll continue, and I would say continue with the practice of the object and its glow, and see if it's at all. If you can find a way to connect that with the discussion that starts here on page 178, which will be our reading for next week.